Our speaker today is Dr. Russell Dabbs. Professor Dabbs is a professor of economics, and I hope you will welcome him warmly. He needs it.
Good morning. And let me make sure I'm heard. Good morning. Okay, good morning. Before getting into my main topic this morning, I wanted to put a plug in for the LCU in Washington program by giving you a short report on James Dean, an economics major who is spending this semester in D.C. as an intern at the Cato Institute. The Cato Institute is one of the most prominent of American public policy think tanks. One of its scholars is Michael Tanner, who is well known within public policy circles. James reports that, Mike Tanner is writing a book on poverty, so I've been doing a good bit of in-depth research on that for him. While I do some short-term things, such as research on tax proposals by candidates, the poverty research is what occupies most of my time, unquote. Wow, helping Michael Tanner do research work on a poverty book at the Cato Institute. Just think what that's going to look like on his resume. But that's not unusual, not for students in the LCU in Washington program. Our business students have had internships with the Federal Trade Commission, Department of Interior, Financial Services Roundtable, congressional offices, and other placements. It's a great opportunity, and I urge you to learn more about it by visiting the LCU in Washington website or contacting the program coordinator, Dr. Stacy Patty. We're in the midst of a year-long exploration on the meaning and practice of justice. One of several events related to this initiative so far was the Truth, Reconciliation, and Justice Conference held last month here on campus, which focused on lessons to be learned from South Africa's transition away from the political system of apartheid. Next semester, the School of Business will sponsor a program on economic justice. The main event is scheduled for Thursday, March 3rd, and will feature Dr. Andrew Youngert, professor of economics at Pepperdine University. Professor Youngert is spending this academic year on sabbatical at Princeton University, and we'll be getting more word about this periodically out as that date approaches. Along those lines, I have been asked to say a few words this morning about economic justice. This is a huge topic, and so I'll leave it to our March conference to flesh out what it means in greater detail, and limit my comments here to some personal observations about how economists tend, and let me stress, tend to approach the subject. I think the tendency amongst economists is to approach it very hesitantly. The most influential economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, once wrote, "The theory of economics does not furnish a body of settled conclusions. It is a method rather than a doctrine, an apparatus of the mind, a technique of thinking." I think in general, economists tend to see economic justice as a somewhat nebulous term, and debates about it as doctrinal disputes reflecting personal preferences and beliefs, and thus outside their scope of expertise. It's not that they aren't interested in the subject, not at all. I just think that they tend to see the term as a bit too broad and would prefer to narrow the topic down a little bit, maybe take a little air out of it, if you will. For instance, instead of the term economic justice, economists tend to use the less intimidating word equity or fairness, and see equity as a goal to be balanced against another important goal, efficiency. Efficiency can be thought of as getting the most out of the least, the most amount of goods and services using the fewest amount of scarce resources. In my diagram, efficiency and equity are overlapping to indicate that sometimes these goals are not at odds and may actually complement one another, but sometimes they are at odds and there may be tensions between them. Sometimes we may have to trade off one for the other. Now, economists are quite comfortable with the term trade-offs between labor and leisure, current consumption versus future consumption, etc. People in societies make choices and trade-offs all the time. But let me offer an example of why I think it's worthwhile to consider that trade-offs between efficiency and equity, why we should consider some of those trade-offs, and why a single-minded focus on equity may not only sacrifice efficiency, but could actually lead to a less equitable outcome. One important area of economics is tax policy, and it is entirely coincidental, I think, that the passage from Romans today had to do with taxes. Tax policy economists are always in search of the optimal tax, meaning the most efficient way to raise tax revenue to fund public programs. An optimal tax would be one that raises the most revenue using the least amount of resources and introduces the fewest distortions to people's normal economic behavior. To the extent that resources are used to avoid a tax, it introduces inefficiencies. So optimal taxes are those that are the least avoidable. If you can't avoid a tax, or if a tax is small enough that it doesn't create much of an incentive to avoid it, you won't bother spending the time and effort to do so. Just go ahead and pay the tax and get on with your life. So in general, an optimal tax is one that is small and unavoidable. Consider the sales tax. It would seem the most efficient items to tax would be necessities like food. After all, everyone needs to eat. So presumably a small tax on a large number of necessities like food would raise a lot of revenue while introducing the fewest distortions on people's behavior. But in fact, if you go to the grocery store, you'll notice that most food items are actually tax exempt. Why? Well, there's some notion that taxing food is unfair, especially for the poor. Taxing bread and milk seems particularly heinous. And yet it's not only the poor that buy bread and milk and other necessities, so do the rich. They are also exempt from paying taxes on food. Is that fair? This might lead one naturally to think about what the rich buy that the poor do not, what we might call luxury goods. Maybe instead of taxing the purchase of necessities, we should tax luxuries. And that has been and is done. But remember, a virtue of taxing necessities is the difficulty or pointlessness of trying to avoid the tax. Since everyone needs to eat, everyone will ultimately have to pay a tax on food, and so a small food tax could presumably raise a lot of revenue without causing much distortion. On the other hand, how avoidable are luxury taxes? Do you need luxuries? The very term suggests not. And those that purchase them, the rich, how easy is it for the rich to avoid paying a luxury tax? Not evade, which is illegal, but avoid, which is not. And how high must the tax be to actually raise a significant amount of revenue, since there are relatively few rich people and relatively few luxuries compared to necessities? And who will ultimately bear the burden of the tax? Will it really be the rich? This is not simply a theoretical question. For example, in 1990, in order to try to close a budget deficit, the federal government passed, with great fanfare, a budget bill that included a number of tax hikes, including a big increase on certain luxuries like the purchase of yachts. With much less fanfare, the tax was repealed 3 years later. Why? I mentioned Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute a few minutes ago. Let me let him tell you why. In a 2011 New York Post article, Tanner wrote, quote, "The result of the luxury tax was the virtual destruction of the domestic boat building industry. Sales of luxury boats dropped 70% within 1 year. Several manufacturers went bankrupt. More than 25,000 workers lost their jobs. And because so few boats were sold, the tax didn't even generate much revenue. At the end of the day, the millionaires and billionaires were still rich. But thousands of hardworking middle-class Americans ended up out of work. The tax was repealed by a lopsided and bipartisan vote in 1993, unquote. This is a classic example of one of my favorite features of economics, is that it's that it helps often to highlight the so-called law of unintended consequences. In my example, grocery store food is largely tax exempt because it doesn't seem fair to tax the food of lower income people, even if the tax rates are very low. And yet the unintended consequence may be that the tax rates they pay on other non-exempt items may have to be that much higher to generate the same amount of revenue. Meanwhile, the rich get the same tax break as the poor. And so why not tax what the rich buy and what the poor do not? That may have the unintended consequence of actually hurting lower and middle income workers while leaving the rich no worse off than before, since they could still buy the same goods from abroad from countries that did not have such a tax, or simply use the money in different ways, perhaps for around-the-world cruises on luxury liners. And by the way, another more striking example of the law of unintended consequences was in the news last week, as China announced the relaxation of its one-child policy, which its government imposed 35 years ago to stem population growth. Now they fear that it has resulted in too few young people to support their aging population. But another unintended consequence of the policy, even more perverse, is that it increased the incentive for sex selection by parents, as families there tend to prefer boys over girls as their one child. As a result, millions more baby girls have been aborted than boys, such that the boy-girl birth ratio is now heavily and unnaturally lopsided in favor of boys. What does all this have to do with economic justice? Well, economic justice can be thought of as a doctrine or a set of beliefs that people have about economic matters. Those beliefs may be formed in a variety of ways and be part of a general philosophy about the world. For instance, there are some philosophies that are materialist in nature, which deny, ignore, or devalue the supernatural or spiritual realm. For example, there are some we might call social Darwinists who believe that the survival of the fittest applies not only to biology, but also to social and economic relations. In their eyes, justice is allowing the producers in society to flourish, and that injustice comes from roadblocks placed in front of the productive members of society by the envious. I think that an example of a social Darwinist is the writer Ayn Rand, who's most famous for her work, for her book, Atlas Shrugged. There are some materialists who are Marxists, who believe that the history of the world is a history of class struggle between the haves and have-nots. Injustice is the oppression by one class over another, and justice is achieved by the oppressed class banding together to throw off the bonds of oppression. Supernaturalists, those who believe in a spiritual realm beyond the material world, tend to believe that justice is a divine order, and that exists outside the natural world, and that we seek to make part of the natural world. And of course, here at Lubbock Christian University, we most seek to know what God's perspective on justice is, although we also seek to understand other views of justice too. What those various doctrines are, and how they are formed, and what they are based on are all interesting and important, and I'm sure and I hope they will be a big part of our March conference on economic justice. But I would like to suggest another way that we might think of the term economic justice. The full title of this year's initiative is Thinking Critically About Justice. And in that spirit, I see economic justice as a way of thinking about justice, not focused merely on doctrines or solely on the idea of who gets what, but using economic principles to help study issues, to explore how incentives are structured, to identify both overlaps and tensions between equity and efficiency, to recommend thoughtful policies, and to uncover possible unintended consequences of well-intended and sometimes not so well-intended policies. In my tax policy illustration, the unstated but implied assumption is that we seek policies that favor the poor and call on the rich to bear a greater burden. That was, in effect, a doctrinal assumption, and it's worthwhile to examine that doctrine. But the interesting thing about my tax illustration, I think, was analyzing how and whether policies are effective in bringing about desired doctrinal goals. When we have our conference next March on economic justice, I'll wager that much of the discussion will center on issues of poverty and income inequality. Few, if any, will not be interested in these topics. Few, if any, will not have some set of beliefs about them. Few, if any, will not have as a goal the betterment of the material lives of their fellow human beings. So likely, the most interesting questions will not concern the doctrinal goals themselves, but what is the most effective way to achieve them? As I mentioned at the outset, economists tend to be hesitant to pronounce upon what is just. The economic way of thinking is, I think, a useful means of analyzing proposals to make the world a more just place. My hope is that at next spring's conference, that it will be a time of fruitful discussion, not only about doctrines of economic justice, but also about the means and methods for achieving it. Thank you for your attention. You're dismissed.